The best old-time radio from people you trust. The Radio Nostalgia Network, where the oldies are still young.
In the dream, you are falling, lost in the listening distance, as dark locks in.
We were at Eton together, and afterwards at Christchurch, and I always got on very well with him. But somehow he was a man about whom none of the other men cared very much. At Oxford, it wasn't merely his studious ways and his love of science that went against him. It was a certain habit he had of gazing at us through narrowing lids and a bored air of belonging to another, higher race. A wild paper on black magic, which he read to the Essay Society, filled to overflowing the cup of his college's contempt for him. When we went down, I noticed that the sentiment of dislike which he excited in most men was curiously in contrast to the emotions which he inspired in women. They all talked of him with undisguised enthusiasm. The day came when he met Kate Danvers. She behaved like all the rest of the women, and to her, quite suddenly, Hurst threw the handkerchief. His family was good, and his means not despicable, so he and she were conditionally engaged. People said it was a poor match for the beauty of the county, and her people, I know, hoped she would think better of it. As for me, well, this is not the story of my life, but of his. I need only say that I thought him a lucky man. I went to town to complete the studies that were to make me a doctor. Hurst went abroad to study hypnotism and prepare notes for his book on black magic. This came out in the autumn and had a strange and brilliant success. In the spring, they were married. I was not present at the wedding. The practice my father had bought for me in London claimed all my time, I said. It was more than a year after their marriage that I had a letter from Hurst. "Congratulate me, old man. Crowds of uncles and cousins have died, and I am Hurst of Hurstcote. The place is all to pieces, but we can't live anywhere else. If you can get away, come down and see us." In September, I went to visit him. Hurst met me at Pevensey Station. "Let's walk up," he said. "Ah, but it's good to see you again, Bernard." It was good to see him again, and to see him so changed. He was much stouter, and his face, it bore no more the inquiring, half-scornful look that had won him such ill will at Oxford. "How well you look," I said, as we walked along the level winding road through the still marshes. "How much better you mean, Bernard?" he laughed. He had not lost his old knack of reading one's thoughts. He flung his arm over my shoulder with a frank, boyish gesture of affection, quite foreign to his nature as I had known it. "And I know why you didn't come to our wedding," he went on. "But that's all right now, isn't it?" "Yes," I said, for indeed it was. We walked on in satisfied silence, till we passed across a moat, and Hurst pulled a knotted rope that hung beside the great iron-bound door. A bell clanged loudly inside. The great door of Hurstcote Castle swung back, and there stood Kate, a thousand times sweeter and more beautiful than ever. It was a pleasant fortnight I spent with them. They had one tower completely repaired, and in its queer eight-sided rooms we lived, when we were not out among the marshes or by the blue sea at Pevensey. I have never seen any two married people so utterly, so undisguisedly in love as these were. The days went by, dreamlike, and brought the eve of my return to London and to the commonplaces of life. We were sitting in the courtyard. Hurst had gone to the village to post some letters. A big moon was just showing over the battlements when Mrs. Hurst shivered. "It's late," she said, "and cold. The summer is gone. Let us go in." So we went in to where a wood fire flickered on a brick hearth, and a shaded lamp was already glowing softly. "I'm so sorry you're going," she said presently. She was silent a minute, and then shivered again. "I think, don't you, that there are some things one is not meant to know?"
"I suppose so, yes."
"Did it never frighten you in the old days?" she went on. to see that John would never... was always... But he's given all that up now. Oh, yes, ever since our honeymoon. Do you know, he used to mesmerize me. It was horrible. And that book of his... I didn't know you believed in black magic. Oh, I don't, not the least bit. But those things always frightened me just as much as if I believed in them. But John... Ah, there he is. Let's go and meet him. The next morning, Hurst came down to breakfast, looking horribly worried. I say, old man, are you really set on going back to town today because Kate's awfully queer? I can stay if I send a wire, I said. I wish you would, then. She's been off her head most of the night, talking the most astounding nonsense. You must see her after breakfast. I'll see her now, if you like. And he led me up the winding stair to the room at the top of the tower. I found her quite sensible, but very feverish. It seemed to be a sort of aggravated marsh fever. For the first day or two, I thought it would pass off. But on the third day, I perceived that she would die. Hurst met me as I came from her bedside. "You're wrong," he said abruptly, reading my thoughts as usual. "She won't die. She can't die." "She will," I answered. "Send for any other man you choose, but nothing short of a miracle can save her." I wrung his hand. He returned the pressure, but said almost cheerfully, "You know your trade, old man, but there are some things you don't know. You mark my words, she won't die. You might as well say, I was not long for this world." "You," I said with a touch of annoyance, "you're good for another 30 or 40 years. "Exactly," he rejoined quickly, "and so is she. Her life's as good as mine." At dusk, on the next day, she died. He was with her. She had been unconscious for some time when suddenly she raised herself in bed and cried out in a tone of acutest anguish, "John, John, let me go, for heaven's sake, let me go." Then she fell back, dead. He would not understand, would not believe. He still sat by her, holding her hand and calling on her by every name that love could teach him. I began to fear for his brain, and I saw plainly enough that he would never consent to take the necessary steps for the funeral. While I spent the day in considering the matter, John Hurst passed the day beside his wife's body. Then I made up my mind to try all my powers to bring him to reason, and to this end I went once more into the chamber of death. I found Hurst talking wildly in low whispers. He seemed to be talking to someone who was not there. He did not know me, and suffered himself to be led away. He was, in fact, in the first stage of brain fever. I actually blessed his illness, because it opened a way out of the dilemma in which I found myself. I wired for the local undertaker, and in a week she was buried. John Hurst lay unconscious and unheeding, but I did not look forward to his first renewal of consciousness. A few evenings later, I found him excited and feverish, but quite himself mentally. "There's no brain disturbance now. I'm not mad or anything." "No, no, my dear fellow. Everything is as it should be." "Then," he answered slowly, "I must get up and go to her." In moments of intense mental strain, the truth sometimes sounds brutal, horrible. I don't know what I meant to say. What I said was, "You can't. She's buried." He sprang up in bed and I caught him by the shoulders. "Then it's true, and I'm not mad. Oh, great God in heaven, let me go to her, let me go." I held him fast and spoke. "We're old friends, and there's nothing I wouldn't do to serve you. Tell me what you mean. I will go if you can collect yourself and tell me why." He lay back on his pillows, white and ghastly. His thin features and sunken eyes showed hawk-like above the rough growth of his 4 weeks' beard. "Look here," he said. "When I married her, I gave up hypnotism and all the old studies. She hated the whole business. But before I gave it up, I hypnotized her. And when she was completely under my control, I forbade her soul to leave its body till my time came to die. "My dear old man," I said gently, "dismiss these fancies and face your grief boldly. She is dead, and her soul is with God who gave it." "No. Ever since I've been ill, I've seen her every day, every night, and always wringing her hands and moaning, 'Let me go, John, let me go.'" "Those were her last words indeed," I said. "It is natural that they should haunt you." His answer came almost in a whisper. "She is dead, but her soul has not left her body." "Her soul is with God," I repeated stupidly. "I must go and see for myself," he said. Then I knew all in a minute what to do. "I will go. I will open her coffin, and if she is not as other dead folk, I will bring her body back to this house." "Will you go now?" he asked with set lips. "Yes, now. But you must swear to lie still till I return." "I swear it." I saw I could trust him. He called weakly after me. "Think what she must feel, Bernard. Out of the body, and yet tied to it, all alone among the dead. If I have really fettered her soul, there is but one way. I must die too. Her soul can leave her body when I die." I left him and went out across the world to the church, but I did not go in. I leaned on the churchyard wall and thought of her. I had loved the woman and remembered it in that hour. As soon as I dared, I went back to him and told the lie that I thought would give him most ease. "There is no hope," I said. "You will not see your wife again till you meet her in heaven."
"And there's no doubt?"
"There is no doubt."
"Then I am mad. But you're a good fellow, Bernard."
He seemed calmer and fell asleep with my hand on his. When I went into his room next morning, he was gone. On his pillow lay a letter addressed to me.
"You lied. Perhaps you meant kindly. You didn't understand. She's not dead. Goodbye."
I ran all the way to the church and entered by the open door. The stone that closed the vault of the Hearst of Hurstcote had been raised and was lying beside the dark gaping hole in the chancel floor. I went down into the vault. Weak, exhausted by illness and sorrow, John Hurst had yet found strength to follow his love to the grave. He had opened her coffin, and he lay on the floor of the vault with his wife's body in his arms. He had been dead some hours. When I told my wife this story, her eyes filled with tears.
"You were quite right. He was mad," she said.
"But sometimes, when I wake in the grey morning, I wonder, was I right, or was he? For, and it is this thing that haunts me, when I found them dead together in the vault, she had been buried 5 weeks. But the body that lay in John Hurst's arms, among the mouldering coffins of the Hursts of Hurstcote, was as perfect and beautiful as when first he clasped her in his arms, a bride.